Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of many books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, we thought today we'd do a conversation on what's happening in the economy and the financial markets. We have several blog posts that you've been writing about recently, and so we wanted to explore how speculative bubbles have replaced productive investing and how this and excessive debt as well is undermining the real economy. So that's one point of focus. And then also about the reflation, inflation, trade, all of the debt that's been created and is still being created, and how that speculative bubble pops. What are the potential scenarios? Could we result into a deflationary purge of speculation, or how do you see that evolving? So let's focus on those two questions. So maybe we can begin with your initial thoughts on what's happening in the real economy relative to investing or speculative trading.
Right. So, Richard, what I've been trying to focus on in my recent blog posts is the relationship between earnings, you know, which is the wages, and even enterprise earnings, you know, profits, and how those relate to debt. Because if your wages of your 95% of your workforce have been stagnating, as is the case in the U.S. since the late 70s, about no later than about 1980, then how is it possible for your workforce to continue servicing higher and higher debt? Because their wages are not rising in terms of the purchasing power of their earnings. And so that's what's happening in the real economy, right? And my second post is on the velocity of money and the growth of the money supply, because these are related. In other words, if your workforce earnings are stagnant, then the only way that they can borrow more money or support more taxes to support more government debt is if you drop the interest rates, right? You got to keep lowering interest rates decade after decade, so that your workforce can continue to support more debt, because they're not making any more money. So the only thing that can change is the amount of interest due on their debt, and then of course that's true for private debt such as credit cards and student loans and mortgages, and also public debt, right? That the borrowing by local and state and federal government, this whole idea of lowering yields to zero, one of the byproducts of that is to push capital into speculative gambles. Because if you're earning either close to zero or possibly even an actual negative yield once inflation's accounted for, well, then why are you going to buy a bond that you're going to lose money on? Right? I mean, it's just you can't do that. And so everybody is chasing these speculative investments. And it seems like in the current context, it's reaching an apex of speculative frenzy, right? That we, before we started recording, you and I were just sort of, you know, chuckling about these extremes in GameStop and non-fungible tokens and some of the cryptocurrencies and so on. And what we're talking about is that these speculative bubbles are taking capital and talent away from productive uses in the real economy. and maybe you can, you know, elaborate on that. But, you know, if you take away your capital and talent and you put it all in speculative kind of just gambles, well, your real economy is going to suffer. And I think that's partly what I would argue is happening with why money velocity has absolutely been tanking for decades. You know, it's a sign of an extremely unhealthy economy.
Yeah, great. And you have a great pyramid chart or graph in the first article you mentioned. Can you elaborate on that? It's called the debt disposable earnings pyramid.
Yeah, what it's an inverted pyramid in that the apex of the pyramid's at the bottom and the huge base is at the top, and the little apex is earnings and specifically disposable earnings. And then the giant base that rises up on top of that apex is, of course, all the debt. And I think the key point that I was trying to make here is if your workforce's wages are stagnant in terms of like their purchasing power, like they're basically flat, never mind they go up a little bit, but it's just basically keeping track with inflation at best. What happens is if the cost of those of the big ticket essential items, such as rent, mortgages, healthcare, higher education, childcare, these are the big ticket items. We're not talking about like a TV that you save $50 on or something. We're talking about things that cost tens of thousands of dollars annually or over the course of, you know, of the decade. And so if those essentials, non-disposable, you know, expenses, if those are rising, it means that your disposable income, the money you have left after paying all your essentials, is declining extremely rapidly, you know, because it's like you can't get blood out of a stone, so to speak. Once you've devoted 90% of your income to essential expenses, you only have 10% left to service any kind of debt with. And so the more debt you take, even at 0% interest, you still have to pay the principal, you know, like on an auto loan or whatever. And so it's like the workforce is, I think, run out of rope. It's run out of income with which it can service more debt. And so in a way, I think we could argue the same is true of many state and local governments, that they're selling, you know, bonds for infrastructure and so on. But it's like even at a low interest rate, that servicing of that debt starts eating into their general revenue funds, and there's less and less disposable income to devote to further debt. And so I kind of divided debt, whether it's private or public, into the original kind of small amount of debt was the debt that could in fact be paid off over time, right? Back when we weren't in a credit bubble. Then there's the debt that will never be paid off, but the borrower can actually at least service the debt out of their income. Then the biggest and newest layer of debt is debt that is like zombie debt. In other words, the borrower can't even pay the loan payment without borrowing more money. and that's kind of like how we see how Japan's been doing it, right? In order to make the interest payment on their enormous, you know, public debt, they have to borrow more money to make the interest payment. And so I think that's where we're at in terms of the dynamic between disposable income and debt. And so I think it's clear that reaches a breaking point where, you know, you really can't load any more debt on the system. And yet if you don't load more debt on the system, then consumption falls and then you're in a depression. So there's a dynamic there that you can't really get around, you know, so you can create a zombie economy, but it's not a productive, healthy economy, nor is it sustainable in the long term. And you mentioned a quote by Mises about what happens when you're relying on a credit expansion for your economy. And I think that maybe that would be, I forget exactly how it goes. Maybe you can help me out with that.
Yeah, sure. So it's Ludwig von Mises, an Austrian economist that mentioned that there is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of voluntary abandonment of credit, further credit expansion, or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. So he essentially lays out two options, you know, the idea of the entire credit debt heap as being abandoned, or, you know, the whole creation of that credit process to stop, in which case the whole heap comes down. We have a purge of speculation of all of the debt, or it comes later as a disruption in the currency system, or a sacrificing of the currency, if you will, over a period of time. So one of the other is likely to happen. Do you see one of those as more likely than the other?
Well, that's a great question, and maybe you can provide an answer, you know, as well. I think my personal view is I don't see how you cannot default on debt at some point, and then especially in terms of speculative gambles that are financed by debt, right? Margin accounts and other things, is that there's no real collateral there, right? There's like an asymmetry between the perceived value of something and its actual value in a real economy. And so when those two factors realign, it's the speculative value that's going to collapse. And so if so much of your so-called collateral or wealth in the system is this sort of speculative phantom wealth, when that goes away, then you have a deflationary crash. And so alternatively, if you're going to try to avoid that at all costs, then as you're saying, then you end up sinking your currency. And so maybe you could go into how, what happens when a central bank, like maybe the European Central Bank, if it's going to go for that, that alternative of undermining its currency, then it would use so-called yield controls.
Yeah, exactly. And that's happening this week as we speak in Europe, the concept of yield curve control, YCC, as a form of financial repression. Essentially, the idea is to fix the yield curve, the yield curve being the graph or the chart of interest rates in terms of the structure over time, short-term interest rates, long-term interest rates, how that curve looks like. So you have the control of that along all aspects of the yield curve as what essentially has been announced by the European Central Bank this week. So they're taking the approach of, looks like, of sacrificing the currency, because what'll it necessitate is employing the currency to print money out of thin air to do this yield curve control. And so you'll have over time likely rising inflation and debasement of the currency, and essentially the concept of negative real yields, where the inflation rate is higher than nominal interest rates. That's what is meant by negative real yields. So that'll likely be in place for a long time. And so this whole process of financial repression will then reduce the burden of government debt and private debt over a long period of time, given the rising inflation, all of those factors, with debasement of currency. I mean, alongside that, you may also have capital and exchange controls, the loss of government confidence resulting as well. So overall, the currency could likely take a significant drop. And as Ludwig von Mises said, a total catastrophe of the currency system. So looks like we may be heading in that direction. Your thoughts?
Yeah, Richard, I marked up, I annotated two charts here in my post on dead money, is what I called it. The first chart is of M2 money stock, right? The M2 money supply. And these are charts from the St. Louis Federal Reserve, Fed database. And it's it shows the money stock here in the U.S. Accelerating in a really parabolic move. And what I did here was mark the pre-pandemic and post-pandemic so that we can set aside the whole pandemic expansion of money, which is, of course, unprecedented. But even before that, we're looking at, say, the post from the 2009 global financial crisis and that short recession, that the money supply almost doubled from 2009 to, January 2020. And so you go, well, wait a minute, wasn't the economy healthy and weren't we going great guns? And it's all like, well, actually, the money supply is completely outstripping GDP. In other words, your actual gross domestic product, like your real economy in terms of production of goods and services. And so on this chart that I marked up, since the beginning of financialization, globalization, and therefore of financial repression in 1981, GDP has gone up about 6.5-fold in the U.S., right? Nominally, right? Not adjusted. The money stock's gone up over 12-fold. So we've had to create an enormous amount of money to get any kind of growth at all, right? And so that kind of suggests that we're pushing on a string here, right? That the efficacy of that dynamic is declining. And then I marked up a chart of the velocity of M2 money stock. In other words, the velocity of money. And this is like how many transactions occur over a set period of time, right? And so if each dollar trades, between changes hands many, many times, then that's you have a high velocity of money. And if it basically stagnates and sits, in a tin can in the ground, it's you have a very low rate of money velocity. And in general, a high rate of money velocity is considered evidence of a productive, vibrant economy, right? That there's reasons to be trading currency for goods and services, and new enterprises are starting, and all this activity is evidence of a productive, good economy. Well, we can see from 1960 through about 1980, which was considered a period of widespread prosperity, low inflation, until the late 70s. The money velocity stayed in a rather narrow band, fairly high. And then it shot up to a peak at 1997 at the peak of the internet boom. And I mean the internet boom, not the dot-com stock bubble. I mean the influence of the internet's technologies on the real economy. In other words, there was tremendous gains in employment. Earnings were higher. And the economy was becoming more productive. That was all in the real economy. So this money, the money velocity increasing was evidence of that. It was a real boom. It wasn't just a speculative bubble. Since that point, money velocity's done nothing but decline by huge leaps and bounds. So every time we get a speculative bubble, that the Federal Reserve and other central banks create a credit speculative bubble, when that pops, which it always does, then the money velocity has taken a huge leg down. And so what we now have is an economy in which there's very little money velocity, which I call a dead money economy. And this is just as a high rate of money velocity indicates a productive, vibrant economy, an economy with very low money velocity is an economy that's mortally wounded. You have to say that it's not productive and it's not vibrant. It's basically hanging on by a thread, or it's just in a doom cycle, to Mises' point, right? That your choice of poison is, deflationary crash of all the debt, that's not based on anything but speculation, or you can undermine your currency to the point where it loses, its purchasing power and your economy is destroyed that way. So, I guess I wanted to ask you you know, we've had discussions in the past over what alternative is there to this kind of really unproductive and unsustainable gambling, you know, in speculative bubbles. What alternative do we have? And of course, you and I both know we could be investing in decentralized, sustainable, environmentally productive enterprises, right? Yeah, maybe exactly. You can speak to that. Like, that's the alternative.
Exactly. We've done a lot of research that is based on using the principles of the Austrian School of Economics, which is a body of knowledge that was initially started back in the 1870s in Vienna, Austria. Nothing really to do with the country of Austria, other than that the initial economists from the school of thought originated from Austria. And it's gained a remarkable following in recent years because it helps very much to understand what has been happening in the economy and the financial markets, the effects of what central bank policies have been doing to the economy and the financial markets, as well as government fiscal policies. So we've done a lot of research based on that, and we've developed a allocation model as well. We call it the CEDAR portfolio. Essentially, we have distilled the principles into 14 factors that have 7 quantitative and 7 qualitative division between those 14 factors. And so we look at what the Austrian School of Economics has emphasized, and that is value placed on limited debt, right? Limited leverage. And this is a key asset feature given today's economy beset by excessive debt and leverage. So there's an emphasis of value placed on that. Businesses that have limited debt, limited leverage, as well as high positive cash flowing type of businesses, positive, you know, and high earnings per share. We also look at the idea of the element of scarcity, so that can be emblematic in terms of how the shares outstanding are in their state. Are they stable? Are they decreasing? Are they increasing? Generally we like to look at things that are stable, right? There's no more issuance of shares. Now, if there are share buybacks, if that is happening because of increasing debt to do that, that's frowned upon. But if it's using cash on hand, that's okay. So either stable or decreasing, but making sure there's no increasing of that debt. So, you know, we look at that from a quantitative perspective, and all of the metrics that we came up with, we matched all these principles to metrics that can be observed in companies, have actually positive correlation to equity market outperformance. So if you take all of those 7 factors together at the same time, that gives a really big edge for equity outperformance. We also look at qualitative factors, to your point on sustainable enterprises. So the portfolio actually has an emphasis on ESG. So we look for businesses that are helping society and the environment, that have good ESG factors, but at the same time are doing well financially and with respect to equity outperformance. So we have a number of qualitative factors that we look on as well. So altogether 14 factors. And we've done back testing. We've got actual performance results in the form of an active index currently, and it's quite an interesting portfolio. The emphasis on the environment also is using an approach called market environmentalism, which is essentially the alternative Great Reset approach, if you will, as compared to the World Economic Forum Great Reset. And that's because it takes a market environmentalism approach. So we look at emphasizing property rights, decentralized local approaches to the environment, and also approaches that are aligned with the principles of the Austrian School of Economics to value individual freedom and liberty. So that's essentially what we've been doing. But yeah, it is very focused on value type of stocks versus tech stocks, which are very interest rate sensitive. And there's actually some research by Ned Davis Research that estimates that a 2% yield in the U.S. 10-year bond could lead the NASDAQ, you know, which is essentially a lot of tech stocks. So that could lead the NASDAQ to fall 20%. So that's a very interesting fact, because that's what we've been seeing recently, is the effect of rising interest rates on the long end of the yield curve on the NASDAQ, the tech stocks. So we might be seeing a divergence, with emphasis based on more on value stock investing versus tech stock growth investing as interest rates rise. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, I would kind of just wrap up this idea that there are alternatives by just kind of noting that right now, as we've talked about what's wrong with speculative gambling in terms of its negative impact on the real economy, it also creates a really perverse set of incentives for investors, right? Because you're chasing something that is going to collapse. I mean, it's just no bubble has ever not deflated, right? There's no history whatsoever that bubbles rise to infinity. So the system that you've described, being quantitative and qualitative, it shows that there are alternatives and there are good incentives for that. You know, you're not going to make 300% a day in GameStop options, but you're also, you know, not going to lose, you know, your capital, and you're not going to be wasting your time and capital on non-productive stuff, because that's just not productive. And so if we're going to wait for the global economy to become, non-perverse, then we're going to be waiting a long time, right? Because all the incentives are set up for creating these non-productive speculative bubbles. But there are alternatives, and the incentives are already there to do something else with your capital and skill set. And I think that's just enormously positive. And so we basically just have to ignore the credit speculative bubbles and do something more productive with our time and capital. And those alternatives exist.
Exactly. And if you want to give your final thoughts based on the books that you've written to that effect, what would be your suggestions for the economy and for millennials on jobs in terms of that point of view for a productive economy?
Well, certainly decentralization and like smaller scale, being responsive to specific markets and communities. So I think those are generalized dynamics that are indicative of the kind of dynamic, self-organizing, adaptive, and productive systems that we're describing.
Great insight, Charles. It's been fascinating discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. I have samples of all my books, and my archives are free.
Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.
Great. Yeah, we'll end it right there. Cool.
Yeah, we got, that's about a half hour.
Yep.
Yeah. Feel you want me to send you these graphics, or can you just like right click them and grab those charts that I have?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, can do that.
Okay. Because at least there's something for them to, you know, we have some graphics already prepared, and I think I think these annotated charts of the velocity of money and the money stock are, I mean, they're kind of mind blowing. You look at these and you go, wow, the money supply has been soaring. And then the velocity of money has been an absolutely, you know, in a free fall. I mean, it's like, this is obviously not sustainable. But I'm glad that you, I think you did a great job outlining the quantitative part of your business, you know, or the, of your research. And I think that was really important because, because I wanted to emphasize there are incentives already, you know, like you don't have to chase Bitcoin and GameStop to make money. In fact, that's really stupid. You know, we don't want to say that bluntly, but it's like, And so anyways, I feel really good about that. And I haven't, I promised the other participants in our podcast that I would write a blog post about that. I don't, I tried to promote the video as best I could. So I don't know how many views it got, but.
Oh yeah, it was great. I mean, we're, I think we're on podcast number 5 or 6 or so. So yeah, it's coming along. And so actually sometimes I'll be the host and sometimes I'm actually a participant. We had one on nuclear energy the other day where I was a participant because of my, you know, work and research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory on nuclear fusion energy. So that was pretty interesting discussion.
Yeah. Not too many people have that kind of expertise.
Okay.
To say the least.
Yeah. And that's cool. So, so what do you think on a next topic? Just looking at your latest writings. I mean, we can always wait to see how things play out, right, on the economy and financial markets, but just any initial thoughts so far?
Yeah, well, I would always, I'm always happy to talk about this. Again, the markets where we're, you know, and assuming nothing changes in a month, everybody's front running, you know, like speculative inflation, right? Yeah. And so it's like, that's an interesting dynamic because to some degree they're creating it, right? It's self-reinforcing because if you bid up lumber, then lumber goes up in price.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. And so, you know, that we could talk about.
Yeah. And I think, also,
I mean, this is just one idea.
Right. The inflation too is, on the real economy, I think is likely to be, supply, chain disruptions and shortages, right? I think those two.
Yeah.
Is likely to propel inflation. Then there's also this whole thing of, you know, the oil and gas fossil fuels that is going to be likely attacked by, you know, even President Biden, you know, they'll probably go after them and significantly hurt the production, right, of oil and gas. To the point where we'll likely have shortages, I think, because of that. So I think that's coming. And then because of that, you might have oil going up to $100 a barrel, right? Because, and we still need it because the whole thing of wind and solar energy is not likely to make it to 100% because it's just not technically feasible. Not to mention, on solar, if you actually go to 100% solar, you'd actually create a greenhouse gas planet on Earth because the mining and the milling operations to make the and fabricate the solar panels would be so vast that, you know, it would create so much greenhouse gas. Of course, once you have the solar panel, that there's no pollution. But the thing is to make those solar panels in the first place. I mean, the solar and wind can go up to maybe 10% of electricity energy, you know, requirements, but you need, at this point, you still need oil, coal, but and nuclear. So I think that's why they're putting more emphasis on nuclear, right? Bill Gates on thorium reactors, maybe eventually fusion. So that's probably the only way, you know, scalable, right? Can you need something scalable to get up there. But in the meantime, they could run up the price of oil and gas and gasoline prices right through the roof. I think we might be seeing.
Yeah, why don't we talk about that? Because most people have this sort of fantasy view that they think that wind and solar are just, you know, like some sort of easy replacement. Sure. And because of your expertise, then it would be good to talk about nuclear, because so many people have discounted it because, let's face it, the new generation of technology has not really been built yet, right? I mean, there's no thorium reactor that I know of. I mean, everybody's been talking about it for a decade. But I would love to explain to people, and there's lots of other people who've done a better job than me, but you and I can talk to the fact that it's intermittent energy, you know, wind and solar. And when it's intermittent, that means you either have to have an enormous battery storage, and the current systems are only have a couple of hours, you know, even if you have a huge array of batteries. Because then you've got to have natural gas or coal or something to fill in the gaps on when the intermittent. So it's actually expensive because you have to maintain the legacy system to fill in the gaps. And then you need a battery system. And then you have your solar panels and windmills, which many times only last 15, 20 years. So then you've got to replace them.
Yeah.
So it's really problematic, and I think it's really true as you say. I'd love to, the fact that coal is bad, you know, and oil is bad, and solar panels and windmills are good. It's like that's like a policy decision, but it's actually really groundless. You know what I mean? It's actually pretty stupid, and that we can mention inflation, you know. As one of the bad side effects of that misunderstanding of energy or something. I don't know how to put it, but I think it's really good. Supply chain inflation with a focus on energy.
Okay. April 21. Is that good? April 21, Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I marked my calendar.
Excellent.
Okay. Inflation and energy. Okay. Yeah. I think it's clear that Biden's policy is just, it has no connection to reality. You know what I mean?
Right. No, that's true. I know exactly. Oh man, it's going to be, this whole thing will initially drive up very high prices of energy coming. I think I'm afraid.
I think so too.
We might have. Do you have a generator ready in case? I mean, I guess in Hawaii it might be different out there, but we just got a generator here because we're likely going to see rolling blackouts, I think, coming this summer, and we're just getting ready for that. Oh my god!
I think it's a very good idea. One of the reasons why I'm here on the Big Island is we have one of the largest geothermal electric plants in the world. Right. And it's actually owned by an Israeli company.
Okay.
But it supplies about 40% of the electricity. Wow. And we also have wind farms and some major solar. So that's 24/7, right? I mean, the geothermal. So with tourism down, you know, the resorts are running at 25% capacity or something. So I think it would be there'll be a base energy. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't eventually have a generator. But anyways, it's like it's like my little secret. I don't want anybody to figure this out. That the Big Island is very
That's pretty high, 40%. Wow, no, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's actually fantastic. Yeah, yeah,
that's really high. And then there's, like I said, there's wind farms and major solar arrays, you know, that are intermittent. But just the base load is remarkable. You know, so it's almost like having like a Grand Coulee Dam or something, you know, I mean, something that's even better because we're sitting on a really hot volcano that's erupting. So it's not like other geothermal places, they can deplete their their source, you know, the heat is, it's like, no, you're not going to deplete the killer whale volcano. I mean, you know, it's it's like there's no way. It's just an immense hot spot. Anyways, but everything has geothermal if you go deep enough. All right, well, listen, I know it's getting late for you, so thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you so much, Charles. Awesome discussion. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Have a good one.
You too. Yeah.